Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, In the Same Vein, a podcast out of the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. My name is Dr. Christy Slobogan, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics.
Hi, my name is Nonki Nagpal, and I'm a current senior at the University of Rochester, and I'm double majoring in bioethics and psychology. And today we're talking with Dr. Brianna Moore, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics at the University of Rochester, where she also serves as a clinical ethics consultant and directs the Advanced Certificate Program in Clinical Bioethics. She has a PhD in philosophy from Monash University and completed postdoctoral fellowships at the Children's Mercy Bioethics Center and Baylor College of Medicine. Her research interests span medical decision-making, pediatric ethics, community-engaged practice, virtue ethics, and death studies.
Yeah, so it was really nice to get to have this in-depth conversation with a colleague from here at Rochester and in our department, and really wonderful to get to talk to Nonki as part of this conversation as well. What we talk about primarily in this episode is the constantly changing technology that's at the intersection of mental health, pediatrics, and AI. So therapy chatbots or therapy bots. And we talk about the ethical implications and possibilities for this type of technology. We also talk about why children are such an important category to consider on their own and not just as quote unquote little adults. And then we discuss a lot of the risks and the potential or purported benefits of these therapy chatbots, as well as the things that we need a lot more research on. That's kind of one of the main things that keeps coming up, is that we really don't know a lot of what's happening in the AI and health space. It's a really, really enlightening conversation that we have with Dr. Moore.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk to Dr. Moore about this because it connects very closely to my own interests in bioethics. So I've been working over the last year with Dr. Moore on a broad literature review of ethical issues in pediatrics, and she's also mentoring my senior capstone project on how providers define high-quality pediatric mental health care in emergency settings. And something that was really interesting is when Dr. Moore talks about therapy chatbots and their ethical implications, they bring about many of the same concerns around quality of care that I've been studying, and also the specific interests of children. So I thought it would be really interesting to hear a little bit more about Dr. Moore's perspective on how these new technologies fit into the larger conversation about pediatric and adolescent mental health.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you chose to speak with this amazing scholar and ethicist. And I think that people will really enjoy this conversation, and it'll push them to think about this technology in a new type of way.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast episode. We're really, really excited to have this conversation with you. Nonki, do you want to go ahead and start us off with the first question?
Yeah. So to prepare for this interview, we read your article, The Integration of Artificial Intelligence-Powered Psychotherapy Chatbots in Pediatric Care, Scaffold or Substitute. Could you tell us what led you to do this research and why you wanted to undertake this?
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on the podcast. So as a pediatric ethicist, one of my pet peeves is the way that ethical consideration of the implications of new technologies or therapies for children is often an afterthought. I had read some of the literature on the use of therapy chatbots in adult populations, but I couldn't find any robust child-centered discussion or analysis out there, with the exception of one really great paper by Doug Opal, Brent Kias, and Glenn Cohen. This struck me as highly problematic, given the very real way that these could creep into being used by children really, really soon. So I teamed up with a couple of my colleagues, Dr. Sharife Tekin, who's based at SUNY Upstate, and my colleague, Dr. John Harrington, who's also based at the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics here at the University of Rochester. They're experts on the ethics of psychotherapy chatbots and the ethics of AI, and we decided to write a paper exploring the use of large language model-based digital applications in pediatric mental health care. Our goal in this paper was to really sort of start to map the terrain with respect to what makes treating children and designing interventions for children distinct, especially with respect to their mental health. In the paper, we basically argue that if these technologies are going to be effective at supporting and promoting children's mental health, there must be really clear alignment between the design and goals of AI chatbots and the child's medical and non-medical interests. We also argue that if therapy bots are intended to be a form of treatment, which many of them claim they are, there needs to be the involvement of others in the child's care, including a licensed mental health practitioner, to oversee their use, like we would have for any other kind of therapy. Or like medical treatment or intervention. So if therapy bots are intended to be a form of treatment, we also need to have someone involved who authorizes their use, ideally a clinician in conjunction with the child's parents or primary caregivers, with some sort of clear informed consent process. And lastly, we argue that more work is needed to understand how these bots will affect health disparities when it comes to mental health care and outcomes.
Thank you for that. So what is the point of a therapy chatbot, and what's the difference between this and other types of AI? Couldn't someone just use ChatGPT as a therapist?
Someone could absolutely just jump on and use ChatGPT as their own personal therapist. People are for sure doing that right now. We note in our paper that one of the challenges in talking about AI-based platforms, apps, interventions for mental health care is that they kind of run the gamut, right? They range from chatbots to gamified cognitive behavioral therapy to machines that emulate human therapists. We're really interested in the latter. And the difference between an AI-powered therapy bot and other forms of AI is that some of these tools and platforms like Rejoin, Wisa, or Wobot, before Wobot tanked, explicitly market themselves as therapists or therapeutic interventions for mental health. That is, their stated purpose is to be a form of mental health support or treatment. This is really different than other forms of large language models or open and generative AI.
Okay, that's really helpful. Thank you. It's kind of a tangent, but I do want to know why the one therapy chatbot, Wobot, tanked. Maybe we can go back to that, but I just want to put a pin in that you said, oh, before Wobot tanked. And I was like, what is that? What happened there? But you're talking about kind of this, all these different apps that are out there and kind of this landscape of what's available. And so we wanted to hear from you what you thought, or what's the landscape that you think has led to the development of apps and tools like these therapy chatbots for kids. What we want to get at here is both the basic landscape, both in the healthcare setting and in the tech world, that kind of led to this situation where we have these new tools.
I have so many thoughts about this. I feel like there are so many factors that have contributed to this that I'm probably not going to be able to speak to all of them. But I think that a growing population with rising rates of depression and anxiety, eating disorders, other mental health symptoms and psychiatric conditions, coupled with really limited access to timely, effective and affordable mental health support are the primary culprits, right? We are a society also that, for better or worse, is increasingly turning to technology for all manner of social, medical and cultural tasks and fixes. A decade ago, telehealth visits were novel, right? Therapy bots, I think of as just another step in a long march towards most of our lives, including where and how we seek care and meaningful interactions happening online.
Okay, so that's really helpful for knowing kind of why these are being created. But could you speak to or give us a little taste of why one of them did tank, that app Wobot? Do you know?
I don't know. Wobot came out of the NHS. So it was based in the UK and was really touted by the NHS as like this new thing that was going to really help, especially the British workforce. Yeah, Christy, I see you reacting to that.
Yeah, that's kind of wild. Okay.
Yeah, and it was kind of going okay for a while. And I only learned that it had sort of gone under and closed as an app pretty recently through a colleague who's a psychiatrist and bioethicist based in Utah. And I was like, oh my gosh, Wobot's not active and out there anymore. I think there was like a little spike of people finding it helpful when it first started. And then several years into it, it just wasn't impacting. The impression I got was that it was no longer viewed as sort of effective and that it was like sort of not cost beneficial. I don't know, though. I'm not a Wobot expert. Yeah.
I guess I was just looking for the chatbot gossip there. But, but that is really fascinating and also kind of a wild name to give a therapy chatbot. The pun is, it's a lot, but I see what they were trying to do there.
But like 2 out of 10 for execution. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So we also want to ask you about why kids, what are the unique risks and benefits for children here, as opposed to AI powered mental health tools for adults?
Yeah. So in the paper, we discuss the unique interests that children have, the central role that others, typically adults, play in the child's life and decision making, and whether and how the use of therapy chatbots in pediatric populations might perpetuate health disparities in sort of unique ways, which we know that they do, because good quality interventions in childhood or poor quality interventions in childhood have really demonstrated intergenerational effects. As I said, one of my pet peeves as a pediatric ethicist is the way that children are often an afterthought to sort of how things happen in the adult world and sort of what I view as a very adult-centric way of thinking about social programs, medical interventions. Children are not simply little adults or not yet adults. What some scholars call the deficit view of childhood. It's sort of like children are just worse adults, right? I was listening to a great presentation by a colleague, Erica Salter, recently, where she really kind of spelled this out. Children have unique interests, unique worldviews, unique qualities, their capacity for imagination and potential. As I said, their unique interests typically include things such as being able to live and to be protected from pain, injury, and illness. Of course, other people have that as well, but to be adequately nourished and sheltered, to be supported while experiencing difficult emotions, to have an education that includes a diversity of experiences and sources, opportunities to think, learn, imagine, play, have secure, empathetic relationships. It's not to say adults don't have those things, but they're especially important in childhood. I think of children as moral, social, and legally distinct from adults. And the ethically supported use of therapy chatbots, apps, interventions, platforms in pediatric populations has to clarify which of the child's interests are implicated by their use. Basically, the question I'm interested in is what's at stake for children in particular when it comes to the use of these sorts of therapy bots? I think similarly, the children are dependent on adults around them most of the time to meet their basic needs and interests. And by extension, the effectiveness of therapies often depends on understanding the child's broader relational environment and engaging with others within their social network. You can't just kind of engage the child in the way that you sometimes can with an adult who is seeking care or support.
That's really helpful. Thank you. And I kind of want to ask a follow-up question here, which is, you know, you're talking about these particular needs that kids have or the fact that they're often left out of these ethical conversations. So is that why you became a pediatric ethicist in the first place, because of this kind of lack of discussion? Or was there another big reason for wanting to become a pediatric ethicist?
I'm smiling because it's not, and I wish that was the reason why I got into pediatric ethics. I never thought I would work on anything to do with children. I have two parents who are primary school teachers, and I was always like, ugh, kids, like, absolutely not. And when I was writing my dissertation, my doctoral work was about assisted dying for adults, so like very far away from sort of thinking about anything to do with the pediatric context. But when I was a grad student, I started working at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne because I wanted to get exposure to clinical ethics consultation services and how they operated in hospitals. And the Royal Children's Hospital had the only one in Melbourne at the time. And the more I started to see interactions between pediatric practitioners, parents, ethicists, and kids, the more I just got hooked on it. I was like, there's such an important, I don't know, there's just so many important things going on here, and there's a complexity and there's potential to have such a significant impact on families as they move through these really challenging situations. So I sort of fell into it by accident, to be honest. But once I was in that environment, I found what I think of now as my community and my people and the sorts of problems that I get really excited and passionate about.
That's really interesting, Dr. Moore. Thank you for that background. So in your article, you write about the potential social and developmental impacts of these therapy chatbots on children, and this is the area that really interested me in this article. So What psychological risks do you think are most relevant when a child might, one, fail to differentiate between the chatbot and a real person, or two, become too connected to the chatbot, or three, forsake connections with real people in their social networks as a result of their relationship with the chatbot?
Yeah, I think this is the crux of what makes people so uncomfortable about all sorts of uses of chatbots, not just for mental health care, although I think there are sort of distinct worries and risks in this domain, but also the use of AI friends or AI romantic partners. It just, this idea that it's, that we are falling for the bot, right? That we are being tricked by it and that we are buying into the trick, that we are committing to what is fundamentally an inauthentic relationship, that I think is what keeps people up and kind of what makes them just have such strong reactions to this issue. I want to be really clear. I don't think any of the risks that you mentioned are unique to children. I think there are absolutely risks for adults using these bots as well. But we know that children in particular have, studies have demonstrated this, that it is, they have a harder time distinguishing robots and people. They think of them as morally and socially similar, and perhaps they are. Perhaps our technology is getting so good that they will be similar enough one day that it doesn't matter. But most people still think that there is a significant difference between interacting with another human and interacting with a piece of code or a piece of machinery. I confess I'm a little bit of an informed consent skeptic. I'm not sure that we really are capable of or do in fact provide informed consent that the way that we talk about and sort of prioritize in contemporary bioethics, but it does seem to be something really different about an adult who recognizes that there's not a person on the other end of the line, on the other side of the screen, typing back to you, and is okay with that, and is like, hey, if it helps me, what's the big deal, right? Doesn't matter that there's not someone there. This is a helpful activity or engagement for me. I'm not sure that children can discern that in the same way and accept those risks or those differences. So I think there's something particularly pernicious about the idea that these bots would replace a child's social connections at such an important developmental, cognitively and socially, stage of their lives.
So you're saying, like, the risk of some of these slippages between, you know, the AI chatbot and real people could prevent social and psychological development in these children? Is that one of the big risks?
That is one of the big worries. Being a little cagey with my language, I think it's because we need a lot more good quality research on this. I think we don't know the extent to which this would change children's social and cognitive development. I think this is a big worry that people have and that we would need a lot more work on it. I think it's sort of like the worries that people had when online learning sort of took over during COVID, right? I think we're still trying to and will be for years to decades to come, trying to understand the impact of that on kids, of not having that face-to-face connection with educators and or their peers and being able to play in the playground and sort of do those in-person skills building things.
Yeah, we haven't had this technology long enough to actually know what the results might be. So I totally get why a lot of this is, you know, speculative, or you have to kind of hedge your bets or hedge your answers. It makes total sense. So next question from me is a two-part question, kind of a big one, drawing on both your article that we read and from a column that you wrote for Psychology Today that we also looked at. So we would love to hear you talk about the health disparity concerns with this type of technology. And we've talked about some of the other risks. We want to talk about kind of this idea of equity with this technology. Some of the arguments for these therapy chatbots is that they would open up access, but you kind of push against this in the article. So could you elaborate on this seeming paradox of access? And then kind of second part of the question, in your Psychology Today column, you bring up a really insightful concern that people might say, quote, if it's as simple as jumping on your phone for a quick session with your therabot between meetings or while you wait for your kid's soccer practice to wrap up, why haven't you done it already? Why are you still feeling so down and stressed out? End quote. So could you elaborate upon this risk of perhaps too much access for both children and adults. And we loved that way that you phrased it. We thought that was a really helpful way of framing a potential harm of these things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I didn't know if anyone out there ever read my blog, so it's nice to know that a couple of folks have glanced at it. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big worries that I have, and this is not unique to these technologies. I think we see it crop up in all kinds of places within healthcare. It's just this like push to place it all on the individual or the user, right? If it's that easy, if you can just jump on your phone, like, why are you still down? Like, quick, schedule a session. You know, it just, the idea that it's as simple as that, I really worry about that. And as you said, the assumption with these bots is that they will decrease or even eliminate health disparities when it comes to mental health by removing wait lists. I think we are all acutely aware of how long it can take to get an appointment with a therapist and to find someone that you click with and that has an effective therapeutic model for you. So I'm not saying these aren't real worries and things that need to be addressed, but yeah, the party line out there from the app developers is that these technologies are going to remove wait times, enhance access, create personalized therapists that are tailored to the unique needs and personalities of users. But this is an open question. They can say that all they want. We don't know if this is true. As you said, like, it's still too soon to tell, I think, what the impact is going to be. Principles of justice, including appeals to health equity and health disparities, are often vague. And I think that vagueness really serves the marketing and the hype around these technologies. In our paper, we try to get a little more specific about the health disparity related considerations that would need to be thought through to really unpack this issue. So we draw attention to four considerations that we think are relevant to thinking through the relationship between health disparities and the use of these technologies in pediatric populations in particular. And so that's the differential need for sort of high quality mental health care across different children in different places from different backgrounds, the differential screening and referral practices, again, for different communities and the children that live within them. Sometimes that happens in schools. Sometimes that happens in the pediatrician's clinic. Sometimes it happens elsewhere. Like, you just cannot design and implement these without attention to that context. The third consideration is the differential resources that are already available to children, again, within particular families and particular communities, and the differential risks associated with actually using therapy chatbots for different kids, including children from communities who have historically been policed or surveyed more than others, especially when they share sensitive information about their home context and or psychiatric symptoms. So until we've really established whether the bots are effective, for whom and with what short and long-term consequences, I just don't think we should be claiming that they're going to solve the current mental health crisis or shortages.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's really helpful. And so you mentioned the app Rejoin, which is marketed as a supplementary tool rather than as a replacement to traditional therapy. But what are the nuances here? A lot of arguments for AI state that it is just a supplement to human cognition rather than a replacement, but oftentimes the technology isn't used in that way in reality. So is there a similar issue arising in these chatbots?
I want to hear if Christy likes Rejoin better than Wobot.
I mean, I feel like there's no great app name, especially for something as like serious as therapy for kids. Like, how are you going to say something, or how are you going to find a name that sounds sufficiently catchy and serious for what it's doing? So maybe actually Rejoin does that better than Wobot, but I think anything is better than Wobot, if I'm honest.
Yeah. And to be really clear, Rejoin is very explicit about being targeted and only intended for use in adults aged, I think it's 18 years and over.
Got it. Okay.
There are a couple of pediatric specific apps with names like Alongside. That's one of the ones that I think sort of is trying to do this in the right way.
Because that name implies exactly what Nanki was just asking about, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of supplementary thing. If it's alongside, then it's not in replacement of. Mm-hmm. So I like that one.
Yeah. Okay. So the 2% of me that isn't a pessimist thinks that some of these apps and app developers and the companies that they work for are trying to do this the right way, as I said, by encouraging the use of these technological supports as a scaffold and not a substitute or a replacement for seeking meaningful, whether it's therapy or meaningful relationships with actual people in one's life. But I think the allure of becoming dependent or reliant on apps as a first port of call or primary form of support for mental health care can't be overstated. So as a society, we're facing such significant resource shortages when it comes to people accessing really badly needed mental health support. And I think mental health conditions and symptoms are often not easily addressed. There's no quick fix. I also think it's really important to remember that app developers and the companies they work for have significant financial incentives that are driving them. They are often part of like million or even sometimes billion-dollar industries that are competing for users. And a therapist, a human therapist's goal might eventually be to get you to a point where you don't really have to see them very often, right? They'll kind of say like, kindly, I hope I don't have to see you again. That's a nice point to reach, especially if you're going through kind of a really acute period of symptoms or crises. Most AI-powered apps and large language models are designed, they're sycophantic, right? To suck you in and keep you tapping or clicking or talking, right? So I think it's an open question how therapy pod developers think about and integrate or balance these potentially competing priorities.
Yeah, it's really helpful to keep in mind the money side of things and the marketing side of things. Like, these apps don't exist in a vacuum. They aren't just for good. You know, they are also, which is important to keep in mind with almost all medicine in the U.S.
Totally. Again, not unique to just this, right? Like, that is a problem across many healthcare fields. But yeah, I get so frustrated sometimes with the like, this is just all benign, right? And they're just doing this to help people. It's like, no, there are other things going on here. And it's okay for us to talk about them. In fact, it's really important for us to talk about them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like social media companies saying like, oh, this is for connection, like human connection and broadening horizons and da da da. And it's like, no, really, it's to get you in front of the ads that are, anyway.
Yeah.
The pessimism is rubbing off here.
I'm sorry.
No. It's okay. It was already there. You're just bringing it out. Okay. So speaking of kind of technological crutches and, you know, I just mentioned social media, you write in this article about the assumption that because kids are already spending, quote, a great deal of time on smartphones, that they might be more inclined to use a therapy bot than to seek help from a human therapist. So we've kind of already touched upon this a little bit, but is that even true? And how would we know that kids, because you're on your phone already, that you will want a therapy chatbot instead of a real person? Like, how is that argument even getting made?
Yeah, so I think two things are going on here. One is that kids are on their phones more. So we do know that, right? Like, we have really clear evidence of that. Not just kids, everyone is on their phones more, but we know that in sort of pediatric adolescent populations, kids are, screen time has increased significantly and time on social media has increased significantly. What I think you're pushing on is the second part of that line of reasoning, right? Which is like, well, then they're just going to be like, okay, I'll jump on the app and sort of use that to feel a little bit better or to sort of help with some problems I'm having in my life. I think the jury's still out on that one. I have read a couple of studies that where adolescents were interviewed and those sort of suggest that adolescents in particular might be like, yeah, I feel less weird about jumping on and using an app and sort of talking to someone. I'm using scare quotes around talking to someone online is like, that's more normal. I feel less uncomfortable doing that. I think it's really important to think about too that some children might not have access to an in-person therapist, or they may not feel comfortable. There may be more stigma about going and sitting down with an. So none of this is to say that these bots cannot be helpful for some children and adolescents. But whether kids are going to be more inclined to use a therapy bot than to seek help from a human, maybe they're not inclined to do either, right? They're uncomfortable with both. So I don't know. I think I agree with you. I think we don't really know that right now. And a big part of better understanding that would be to conduct more research with adolescents in particular to really understand how they feel about this. One thing I think is hilarious is that adults are always like, kids are doing this. And I think we just don't really know what kids want or what they're really doing. And by the time we figure that out, they're onto the next thing. And like, we're just always behind. And I think we're always trying to play catch up and figure out the best sites to sort of pilot interventions.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Thank you for explaining that a little. So how could clinicians and health professionals help families to understand and weigh the risks and benefits of therapy bots? And also, how can health professionals guide families and children in better understanding this technology?
So I confess, I feel pretty out of my head with this question. I think we tried to tackle this in our paper, but I worry that the recommendations we ultimately made lack nuance and aren't really empirically grounded. I want to say too, I think a lot of the worries that I have really aren't ones that can totally be addressed within sort of parent clinician or parent child clinician relationships. I think there's a role for kind of how we communicate about these bots within the clinic at the bedside, but a lot of them are kind of bigger regulatory issues, right? So I don't want to say anything that's kind of like it's up to the individual pediatrician to kind of figure out how to use these in sort of a responsible way. That is way too much to put on pediatricians who are already sort of trying to do a million things in a 7-minute well child appointment. In the paper, we encourage clinicians to avoid using therapy chatbots in sort of a non-discerning or general way. I think their use is going to have to be, if they're going to be effective, has to be really tailored to particular kids that respond to them well. They're going to be appropriate for some kids. Others are going to need really targeted therapeutic approaches, including dynamic ongoing assessment of their needs and progress. So what we're basically arguing against is just sort of being like, here's the app, off you go, like job done, which I don't know any pediatricians that would sort of take that. But again, there are so many pressures on healthcare providers right now and such limited access to needed supports that I could very much understand if someone felt pressured to kind of just direct a family to an app and lead that with them. We, in the paper, also encourage pediatricians to be really clear when speaking to patients and families, again, in developmentally appropriate ways, that the chatbot is not a person. Just to engage the child to the extent that it's appropriate to do so in a conversation about how there is no one on the other end and then the app is not their friend, to continuously reassess that during follow-up visits. Part of that is also really pursuing good quality collaborative interdisciplinary research on how we communicate about bots, children's social understanding of AI chatbots, whether and how digital apps are influencing perceptions of meaningful relationships and related cognitive and social skills. So we need to know more.
I think we both really appreciate the way that you laid that out so carefully. And so with that in mind, that you know, these conversations need a lot of nuance and that we don't want to put too much responsibility onto, you know, already overworked pediatricians or pediatric healthcare teams. What do you think that those who are perhaps looking to go into medicine, you know, students, trainees, especially those maybe going into psychiatry or pediatrics, what do you think that they should know about this evolving technology?
I also don't feel qualified to answer this question. I feel like I don't know enough about whether students and trainees, especially those going into fields that this is applicable to, whether they're receiving any training or any information about these bots. I was talking to one of the psychiatry residents here at URMC recently, and he was sort of saying that, you know, we talk about the biopsychosocial model here at the University of Rochester, and when we do our history and sort of intake and physical exam with, you know, any patient, pediatric patient, he was sort of thinking about it as like BPS plus D, like a digital intake. So tell me, how do you use devices? How do you use social media? How much time do you spend on the computer? What do you spend time doing? How does that feel? Like, he was sort of saying he wants to expand how we think about history intake and physical to incorporate and normalize talking to our patients about this, since it's such a big part of our lives, particularly for children and adolescents now. And I was like, that is such a great idea. And I think a really powerful first step is sort of thinking about how to train people to normalize talking about it more with the communities that they're caring for.
I absolutely love that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to Davis, one of our incredible psychiatry residents. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Dr. Moore. And what do you do as a philosopher working on AI and healthcare when things seem to be changing so rapidly? How do you keep up with the technological advances and the attendant ethical questions? And also, have things changed since you published this article in May 2025?
And just to note, we're recording this in September 2025. So things may have changed since May, and they probably will continue to change.
The honest answer is that I don't keep up, especially as a philosopher. So there's two kinds of philosophers in the world. One is like the philosopher of science that's really tech savvy and like on top of programming and all of that computer science stuff. And the other is like the Luddites of the world, right? And I'm that kind of philosopher. I still take all of my notes by hand. I don't keep up. I read what I can when I can. And I talk to colleagues and friends about things that they have seen, read, or are working on. Things have absolutely changed since we wrote and published our article. The first randomized control trial of therapy bots was sort of published earlier this year. More research is coming out, some of it exploring the use of these technologies in children, especially around therapy bots' safety features and suicide risk screening and prevention features. Moving forward, the two things that I sort of keep coming back to and I'm thinking more and more about are the privacy and informed consent-based implications of therapy bots. I think that privacy and consent, these ideas, these concepts reflect values and ethical principles and commitments that might be becoming effectively practically impossible or obsolete in the current digital landscape. So that's kind of where my head's at, and the like a couple of things related to this that I want to do a lot more thinking about and potentially work on.
I also still take all of my notes by hand.
Yeah, that's why we're friends.
and attempt to be a Luddite. But that's really helpful to know that, kind of what you're thinking about next. And I love that I hate the idea that privacy might become like an obsolete category, but I think that's a really important thing to be thinking about as these things continue to develop. Nanki, did you have anything else that you wanted to follow up with Dr. Moore on?
I don't think so. All of your answers were super interesting and helpful in thinking about all of this.
Am I allowed to ask Nanki a question?
Of course.
I mean, Nanki, what are you seeing? You're a college student right now. Like, report back from the ground, from ground zero? What's going on with the youth? What are you seeing? Is this like on the radar of you and friends?
Yeah, well, earlier you were talking about like people using ChatGPT as a friend or in a romantic way, which like we were talking about this earlier, that it's just really weird and like it's a little scary too. And I also, another thing that we were talking about earlier was that people will say that these AI tools are for a support or a scaffold, like you mentioned in your article. But most of the time, at least at school, like what I see is people use ChatGPT to write out a whole assignment or to write out an email. It's not really like, can you help me fix this, or used in a way to help students study. People will just use it to do the whole thing, which I think is interesting thinking about that with the chatbots. But I would say that's what I see like as a student currently.
Yeah, again, like the idea that users are going to be able to be like, well, I've used this enough, right? Or I'm using it in only the intended correct ways. And like, I have enough self-restraint and sort of control to do that is, I think, a very flawed assumption for anyone to be premising their use on. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also really interesting to see how like now professors are incorporating like AI tools into classes, because I was in one class where it was like absolutely no use of AI for anything, like if, you know, nothing. And then I was in a class right after that where they actually demoed how you would use AI to help you in this class, which was just a very stark difference. But I feel like I see that a lot, like people that are totally against it. And then people are like, you should use it. It's more efficient and it's helpful. And we should all be using ChatGPT and other AI tools.
I think we're going to see that in clinical care as well. I think there are going to be practitioners that are like, nope, I'm kicking it old school. I'm sticking to how I've always done it. And there are going to be people that are like, this is coming whether we like it or not. And it does help in some ways. So I'm going to work to integrate it into my practice because that's the direction that everything's going in.
Mm-hmm. You know, the second part of your article title is scaffold or substitute. And that's what prompted us to have that conversation mm-hmm. about AI in classrooms as well. Like, we have the idea, or like the ideal is that it's a scaffold. And then lots of times it just sneaks into being a substitute. And mm-hmm. so we were talking about how that could definitely, we could definitely see that happening.
Translating, yeah.
With therapy chatbots as well. Yeah, absolutely.
I think of these two, like it's a tool like any other, right? There's nothing inherently evil or good about the technology, about the tool. It's about how we choose to use it in practice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Okay, that's a really wonderful set of questions and kind of back and forth that we've had there. And yeah, thank you again so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me on the podcast. It was wonderful. I love talking about this stuff, so it's good.